Welcome back to the Fourth Way Podcast.
In this episode, I had the privilege of speaking with Cody Cook, who is the author of the upcoming book, The Anarchist Anabaptist. And we get to talk a bit about his book in here. And he's also authored quite a few other books, a couple of which I've read, and two of which I highly recommend, especially in relation to this topic here, anarchism. Not quite as much Anabaptism, but What Belongs to Caesar and Fight the Powers were both really helpful. And what I love about Cody, well, there are a couple things I love about Cody. One thing is that he does keep things pretty simple. If you read his newer book on Christian nationalism, it's not quite as simple. He digs a little bit deeper there. But that's the wonderful thing about Cody, is that he is able to condense a lot of information into succinct packages that are easier to comprehend. And he really he has a lot of humility and really seeks to speak to everybody on all sides of an issue and to have good, respectful dialogue with people. And so I would highly recommend you check out those books, as well as listen to some of the other podcasts that he's put out and the interviews that he's done. Whether you agree with him or not, I think you're going to find that he's always interesting to talk to and listen to, because he's just got a great character and demeanor about him. I think with this interview, actually, I think Cody is now the most interviewed person on the Fourth Way. I think this was his third time, and I think there were a couple other people who've made it on twice, but he is the first three-timer here. So I was honored to have him on again and that he'd be willing to come on, and we had a good time. So before we get into the episode proper, I just want to point out maybe a few key things to consider before you listen. So first of all, if you're here primarily for the anarchism, I think that some of my other seasons, some of my other interviews, some of Cody's other books, some of Cody's other podcasts would be better for exclusive anarchism. Because this, I mentioned What Belongs to Caesar and Fight the Powers in particular, but this book here, it's more of a synthesis. I think what you find a lot of times in anarchist communities is that sometimes it's a lot more about what they're against than about what they're for. And as a Christian, Cody and I, we don't like the type of anarchism that throws off Jesus and throws off things that we think are really integral. And in fact, Cody has a book, one of his books called Unhitched, really talks a lot about the centrality of the Bible and upholding that and everything. So we're not the type of maybe Tolstoyan anarchists that are throwing off Christianity. We think that there's a synthesis that needs to come after that, discipleship, community. And so what Cody does in this book is he tries to help that synthesis, to kind of fill the void that maybe anarchism leaves in some people. Okay, you get rid of the state. What does it mean to have community? And so Cody delves into, libertarian community, some of these other ideologies that have some kind of idea of what a community would mean. But even there, it's not necessarily so much a positive community saying, yes, buy local or shop local, don't shop at larger corporations, right? But even there, that's a good principle, but it's not really about a principled community so much. It's you as an individual kind of doing your thing and just make sure you do it locally. So in this book, Cody is going to get into Anabaptism as more of perhaps a synthesis of, we don't like the state, but what then do we do? And he's going to try to help anarchists recognize the importance of that synthesis and putting on the positive. And he's also trying to reach out to the religious people, to the Anabaptists, who have anarchic tendencies of shunning the state and such, but who maybe don't fully embrace that as Cody thinks they should. So we get to talk a bit about those types of things in this interview. And if that's what you're looking for, then listen and go check out Cody's book. We have a link to his book as well as a coupon code in the show notes. So I'll shut up now and let Cody do the talking.
Yes, so my name is Cody Cook. I have been on the Fourth Way a couple times, which has been pretty fun. So I did one with you before. We talked about making a kind of a conservative biblical case for anarchism, and then the second time we talked about hell and in that propaganda series, and that was real fun. This time I sent you a message that I had a new book coming out that I thought might be interesting to you and your listeners. Which is a book called The Anarchist Anabaptist. And so we can get into kind of what that means and what I'm getting at with that. But ultimately, I guess what I'm really doing with that book, especially the primary essay in it, is to argue that kind of behind this, the classical liberal tradition between libertarian thought and then sort of leading into anarchist thought, you have the Anabaptists ahead of it by about 150 years, I think. And they usually aren't given credit for being kind of the originators of this that sort of way of thinking. But and I argue in the book that really they are, that so many of the things that we think of are really important about the restricted role of government, kind of the limitations of government, freedom of religion, being sort of anti-war profiteering stuff, all the stuff that we associate with that libertarian classical liberal tradition. The Anabaptists were already saying that. The Lutherans weren't saying it. The Calvinists weren't saying it, but the Anabaptists were, and they paid a price for it. So we can get into some of the details of how that shakes out. One thing that's going to be, I think, sort of unique in the book is that I have to deal with some of the ways that anarchists, especially kind of more anarcho-capitalist, like kind of free market type anarchists, are going to have that there are some tensions there with how Anabaptism has been, I think, received, especially kind of modern contemporary Anabaptism, that there's some potential conflict there. But also, I think even in the roots, because Anabaptism is very communalistic, and free market thinking tends to be sort of more individualistic, at least in the way it's formulated. So there are some potential tensions there, but they are explored in the book, and we can explore as many of them today as you'd like.
All right. Thank you. I grew up in Pennsylvania. I was around a lot of Anabaptists, and cutting edge is not usually what I would think of when you think of Anabaptists. So it's it because there are a lot of associations that I think people have, especially when it comes to technology and stuff. So I'm really interested to hear how they were cutting edge in that regard, because I think they get dismissed way too easily today.
Yeah, they do. And you've hinted at this, but if anybody's listening and doesn't know what we mean by Anabaptists, maybe they think we're just talking about a Baptist named Anna. It's the, so they were the 16th century movement, kind of on the Radical Reformation, that were really wanting to kind of go back to the New Testament, especially the Sermon on the Mount. They're more well known today by some of their sects, like the Amish and the Mennonites. But yeah, so yes, not seen as particularly cutting edge, very traditional in that sense, right?
So you have a number of other books that I've read before this one and really enjoyed, but they
Thanks.
didn't they were of a very different stream. So before we get into some more of the content, I'd love to know, like, how did maybe talk about some of your other previous works in relation to this one, but how did you move from those works to this one? Because this one, to me, just seems very markedly different.
Oh, interesting. I think the difference here is that I think I'm really sort of grabbing that name Anabaptist and claiming it more explicitly. I think if you go back to my other works, if you pay attention, you'll see that it's there. The Anabaptist thought has, I think, really shaped the way I have approached Christianity since I became a Christian and started kind of learning about church history and digging into that stuff. The Anabaptists always caught my attention in a way that no other groups did. But I always kind of like to think of myself as sort of ecumenical. There was a time where I sort of felt, kind of Protestant, but I didn't really like to say the word because I was like, well, I don't want to define myself based on what I don't like. That's what Protestantism is, to protest something. And so I think over time I've sort of said, there's little things I, could quibble with on, there's things I'd quibble with, like with Menno Simons or some of the kind of broad Anabaptist tradition, things I might not think of that way or disagree with. But the Anabaptist tradition has been, is I think is really one that I want to claim for myself, because it's one that I think is really at the center of how I approach my faith. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm not willing to learn from Catholics or, Lutherans or, Anglicans or something. But I think it's just sort of about acknowledging that most of my, well, a significant amount of my theological debts have to be paid to the Anabaptist tradition. So I think it's maybe more explicit here, but you'll find references to nonviolence and pacifism and things like that, even sort of subtle in some of my other works. So so yeah, we can go from there, but that's maybe I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Yeah, no. And I'm sorry, I don't want to get bogged down in all of this history. I just think I think that your background helps a lot with understanding a little bit more about the book. So last question, then we're gonna get to your book. So for you, because I know for me, as a pacifist and anarchist, even though I would not consider myself Anabaptist, though heavily influenced by them, I know that it was a progression for me, and for me, pacifism came first. So I'd be interested in just hearing, and maybe there were some other issues for you too, but like what came first, the chicken or the egg? And like obviously here, the chicken is pacifism because they're cat words, and the egg is anarchist because they like to throw things.
Yeah, as much as I appreciate like the sort of pietist tradition of conversion and stuff like that, where I am today was not necessarily something that I didn't really get there from like these kind of just single moments, where everything changed. It's kind of been slow. My conversion to Christianity was kind of slow. I had to kind of work it through a little bit. And so there were, I think, maybe pivotal moments if you look back and say, okay, well, here's when maybe I opened up in this way or whatever. I think about the time when I became actually Trinitarian. I was taking a class in the Book of Acts and that opened up to me, because before that I was like, I don't know about the Holy Spirit being like a person. And so, that sort of becomes part of that Christian journey. As for like kind of pacifism and anarchism, it was the same thing. It was bit by bit for me, and I think both regards. Like, I think I was anti-authoritarian first, but that was kind of, there's a little kind of a memoir section of the book where I talk about kind of my journey there. But my anti-authoritarianism was like really not consistently thought out. I would kind of bounce back and forth between kind of right-wing libertarian constitutionalists to kind of like far left, like kind of Black Panthers, Abbie Hoffman type stuff. And so, but I think, when I first kind of heard about the Anabaptists and the pacifist tradition, I thought, not sure if I'm a pacifist, but I'm really, there's something about this that's really attractive. And the way that sort of commitment, that level of, a fidelity to the Sermon on the Mount and to being willing to suffer for their faith. And so, like I said, it was little by little, they all sort of come together eventually, but it's a bit like, I don't know. They're kind of like, you think of like chain mail, right? We have all these pieces that are interconnected, and you sort of push on one link, and the others pull along with it. It was a little like that for me, I think. It wasn't, one thing here, and then the next thing, comes fully formed. It was bit by bit. How
Oh,
about you,
that's
by the
cool.
way?
Yeah, that's not how my brain works.
Okay, so what happened
I
with
go
you?
peace. Yeah, for me it was pacifism. I mean, just recognizing the 2016 election, and recognizing just a lack of integrity and like just people being willing to compromise and be consequentialistic. It threw me back to the Bible. And I was also a deacon at that time, so working with the poor and just seeing our ethic towards, towards poverty and such, and not being a fan of that. When I went back to Jesus's words fresh, I embraced pacifism. And I think it's very hard to be a pacifist who isn't an anarchist, because the government, I mean, runs on violence. But I think you could be an anarchist without being a pacifist.
Well, yeah. So I would say, unfortunately, I think that one downside of where contemporary Anabaptism is today is that you have a kind of a progressive Anabaptism that is like anti-violence, like anti-war, but not actually anti-statist. Like, and so I think in some cases that we haven't really been Because I mean, yeah, you could say, well, they're anti-war, so they're pacifists, but like they're okay with the violence of the state. I don't know. There is a connection there, right? I think once you think through them consistently, one is going to shape the other. So, like, did you have like a almost like a conversion to pacifism? Was it like just kind of a moment where everything kind of flipped, or was there a little bit of a process?
I mean, yeah, there was a process of, and again, it really was working with the poor and just recognizing that like something's not right. Like this Christendom, just like there's something not right with it. And I've talked to a number of other people. One of the guys at Sattler College, can't think of his name at the moment, but talked with him. He was in the Air Force.
Going Dean
And
Taylor?
no, it wasn't him.
Oh, okay. Wasn't Dean Taylor. Okay.
Yeah. And he was just, yeah, it was for him. He's like, yeah, when you see poverty and you recognize, oh, now I can't think of his name either. But anyway, I talked to a number of people who have worked with the poor, and so many people who work with the poor come out as pacifists, and there's a connection there somewhere that I haven't
That's
pursued, but
interesting.
yeah.
You should think about that a little bit more, because I'd like to see like an essay or something from you explaining what you think that connection is. That's fascinating.
Yeah, maybe one day. I'm not as prolific as you. You write books like every 6 months.
Well, when you're not concerned with quality, you can write a lot of books.
Yeah. Oh, speaking of books, let's actually get to your book here. I've long considered, I've been a Protestant my whole life, kind of by default, born into a Christian family and stuff. And like you mentioned, we like to talk about kind of what we're against a lot of times, and we like to think that we think for ourselves. We're very independent minded. But we don't like the idea of being bound to blind tradition. But in your book, you said something that is ambiguous enough that I want you to like elaborate on it here, because I think when you get into poetic language, it's very beautiful and deep, and I want you to unpack this. So you talked about how Protestants ended up putting new wine in old wineskins in regard to government and religion. What do you mean by that? And I think this is really important, because this is what a lot of your book ends up focusing on.
Yeah, so I don't recall using that metaphor, but if I didn't, I should have, because I think it's a good one.
You did. I took it from your book.
Okay, awesome. Oh wow, this is even better than I thought it was. All right, so I mean, I've said before that kind of thinking about in terms of what makes Protestants different than like Anabaptists is that the Protestants vowed to go back to the Bible. They got back as about as far as Saint Augustine in the 400s, and they said this will do. And so why didn't they go further? It's tough to say for certain, but I suspect that the allure of influence was part of it. So like, let's say that you're Martin Luther. You have this conviction that you're willing to die for. At your heresy trial, you say, I neither can nor will retract anything, for it can cannot be either safe or honest for a Christian to speak against his conscience. Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise. God help me. Amen. Right. And so, that sounds like, that emphasis on personal conviction is so important, right? Freedom of conscience, Luther becomes like this, I think, really kind of a symbol of that, being willing to die for your beliefs and being willing to stand up to the state and be an individual. But okay, if something happens though, and what happens? He's got these princes, these leaders, these rulers of government, and who, probably for their own self-interest, they're saying, well, we'd like to get out from under the Pope's thumb. We're going to make this territory Protestant. Can your theology protect our power and influence? And so, Luther's kind of faced with this situation, even that maybe, let's say maybe he is willing to die, but he wants his message to spread. He thinks that it's important. And so I think he compromises. I mean, any qualms that he has, I think ultimately kind of go out of the window as he rationalizes that position that he's in. Or maybe he just genuinely believed that only his views deserve toleration, which, you could maybe see at the time that that was sort of the way they thought about it, that, well, you tolerate the truth, but you don't have to tolerate lies. Lies should be put down with violence. So yeah, I mean, after all that stuff about, conscience and freedom from unbiblical tradition, I ultimately what happens is they just create a different kind of church-state synthesis And it looks a lot like what the Catholic Church had been doing. So th there's a sort of claim to go back to the Bible, but they're kind of just doing the same thing. The one difference is, I think nationalism becomes kind of a new feature of European politics because of the Protestant Reformation. And so, in that and Luther's anti-Semitism, you can draw a pretty straight line to hit to Hitler, unfortunately. And we can kind of talk about this. So your background, I'm trying to remember, are you Lutheran or?
Yeah, so I grew up like Bible Church Baptist-y, but been reformed for the last 15 years.
Gotcha.
So
Okay.
Presbyterian.
Presbyterian. So yeah, and with the Reform, the Presbyterians, when we talk about Anabaptism, there's some interesting connections here to think about the way that sort of these dominoes fall, at least for the Anabaptists. To be an Anabaptist means to be a rebaptizer. And so what they basically said was they, well, okay, well, maybe I'll go back just a little bit. So there's a reason that the Protestants all agreed with Roman Catholicism about infant baptism. And there are theological arguments, and I'm not going to, undermine, what value there is to those. But there's also a political argument for it. And the political argument is, when you are baptized as an infant, you are baptized into a Christian society. And so who doesn't get baptized into the Christian society? Well, it's Jews who are not really considered citizens. And then suddenly Anabaptists, these people aren't baptizing their babies into their Christian societies because they say, well, there is no such thing as a Christian society. There are Christian people. There are people who have made a commitment to follow Jesus Christ, and baptism becomes like this kind of watershed moment that represents that commitment. And so, babies can't make that decision. And so, like, there's these kind of dominoes that fall for the Anabaptists, where all this stuff is interconnected. They're not just rejecting infant baptism and theocracy, coincidentally. They put those things together because they have this whole viewpoint about faith that it is something, it's voluntary and it's sincere. And that moves us out of the kind of territory that unfortunately, that the Protestant Reformation and medieval Catholicism had placed us in. And that was considered very radical at the time.
Yeah. And I did check because I wanted to make sure that it was in your book. It's in chapter 3, by the
Okay,
way.
thank you.
Yeah, because I was worried there for a second because when you first sent me the book and I read like the first 2 pages, I was like, man, this sounds so much like Werner de Eller. And then you're like, yeah, I think I mentioned him in there. And literally, like first chapter, you talk about him quite a bit. So,
Yeah, you'd mentioned Werner. I appreciate that because I like Werner Deller a lot. So that it was nice that you thought of him reading me. So
Yeah,
I think that
no,
was awesome.
it sounded very much like his position, very reasonable and
Yeah,
good.
which I mean, one of the things I love about Werner Deller is he was an Anabaptist who claimed the anarchist label. And what I think I'm arguing is that those labels fit together. And so the fact that anarchists have not been willing to look at Anabaptism and Anabaptists haven't really been willing to consider anarchism is really unfortunate.
Yeah, and I don't know much about Eller, but he didn't strike me as some crazy liberal guy who's on the extreme wing. Like he seemed like a pretty, I don't know, pretty good guy.
Yeah, no, I think he had a very strong commitment to ethics. One thing that's really interesting about him is that he wrote some features for Mad Magazine about a religion. Did you know about that?
Yeah, there's like a I forget Homeward Christianity or something. There's a online resource where they have all of his works you can get.
Yeah, that's right. You can't. Yeah, I think it was called The Mad Morality. So he was one of the major writer on that. But that's fascinating.
It was so crazy to see the different topics that he talked about.
Yeah. Listen, if I could write a feature for Mad Magazine, I would feel pretty complete as a writer. I've got my theological stuff and I've got my Mad Magazine pieces.
I really enjoyed his stuff on Kierkegaard too, because Kierkegaard is like one of the heroes of the faith for me, and Eller has a really good work on that.
Yeah, you mentioned that. I haven't read it yet, but I'll have to add it to my list.
Yeah, it's great. Okay, so Protestants essentially, if I can summarize what you're saying, Protestants, they're the new wine in the old wineskins, and from Jesus's analogy, right? That just ruptures. It doesn't hold. It's no good. And so what was produced after the Reformation? You had A lot of persecution, Christians killing Christians, not such good stuff. Lots of infighting in Europe and everything.
Yeah, the wars of religion that followed, right?
Yeah, and so a lot of people they like to point out the how terrible religion is in history. You know, Crusades, Inquisitions. You know, this right here, this new wine breaking out of these old wineskins and just wreaking havoc and 100 years wars and all kinds of things. Religion is the opiate of the masses, right? But I think something that often gets overlooked, which is where you're coming in, right? You're talking about religion and a baptism. Right, how, saying that this is a love, peaceful religion, but then also you're critiquing government, and I think a lot of times it's easy for people to critique religion and say, "Look at all the killing that religion did," but they kind of overlook how religious the state is, and I think you point that out in a number of places, but you talk about how the state essentially requires the same thing from us. And you do that by zooming in on this idea of the state as having a sacramentum, which is what it had in Rome. And I think a lot of people would say, well, yeah, but we don't do that today. States aren't really religious today like they were. Can you talk about the state now as religion? You talked about Protestantism and the violence of religion. Now talk about how the state isn't much different.
Yeah, well, and I'll start by saying that, I mean, Anabaptism proves that religion is not the primary factor in this violence. The state is the primary factor in this violence. The belief in the state that that we should reject a voluntary faith and a voluntary society because we need to have somebody who's in charge who tells people what to do, and if they don't listen, they need to die or be punished in some way through, you know, through violence. But I mean, just kind of on the opiate of the masses stuff, I mean, you know, Marx's critique is a legitimate one if you apply it to civil religion. You know, most religion throughout history has been civil religion, which is to say it's religion that has been integrated with and serves the dominant social order. And so I think, you know, the fairly unique contribution of Christianity to religious thought is that religion might actually fundamentally challenge the values and assumptions of the order of the day. As opposed to sort of just being, you know, one component of what makes a society. You know, you look at Rome and the way that they sort of approached religion, you know, if your religion can fit into the Roman Empire and you can still be a, you know, good citizen and obey Caesar, that's fine. But if your religion in any way challenges Caesar, that's a different thing altogether. And so that's, I think, what is unique about Christianity. And I think one example we see is what you mentioned, that the Christian use of the word sacrament or sacramentum in Latin. And I think the first Christian use of that word that we have, at least in writing, is from Tertullian, the 3rd century church father. And he wrote about this, you know, Christians, whether Christians should sign up for the military. And he said, quote, "There is no agreement between the divine and the human sacrament, the standard of Christ and the standard of the devil, the camp of light and the camp of darkness. One soul cannot be due to two masters, God and Caesar." Right. And so what did he mean by the human sacrament? We know maybe divine sacrament, maybe he's talking about, you know, baptism or communion or something. What's the human sacrament? You know, for us, it's kind of a churchy word, but in ancient Rome, a sacrament was an oath or a vow where a soldier pledges loyalty to the emperor. And Tertullian's use of the word for religious vows like baptism actually grounds his claim that you can't be loyal to Caesar and Jesus at the same time. You can't make, because a sacrament is an oath, it's a vow. And so, you know, you can't commit yourself wholly to Caesar and also commit yourself wholly to Christ. And so that's what Tertullian gets out of the idea of sacrament. There's an old spiritual down by the riverside. And I doubt the author probably wasn't aware of Tertullian's use of the word sacrament, but they give a really good application of that principle, where they connect the act of baptism with this vow to lay down my sword and shield and to study war no more. I think I quote that in the book, that, but you know, I got to lay down my burdens. I'm going to lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside. Well, what's also happening down by the riverside? They're getting baptized. And so there's this idea that when you go to get baptized and you make this oath to Christ, you set that stuff aside. And then the chorus is, "Ain't gonna study war no more, ain't gonna study war no more." Anyway, so What's happened, I think, unfortunately, really unfortunately, is that Christianity has been co-opted into service as civil religion, despite its natural resistance to it. So, in a post-religious, nationalist age, that means, as Leslie Newbegin had said, got a quote here. It's kind of a longer one. It's not my book, but I came across it late recently, and I thought it was a good quote. Leslie Newbegin said, "If there is any entity to which ultimate loyalty is due, it is the nation state. In the 20th century, we have become accustomed to the fact that, in the name of the nation, Catholics will fight Catholics, Protestants will fight Protestants, and Marxists will fight Marxists. The charge of blasphemy, if it is ever made, is treated as a quaint anachronism, but the charge of treason, of placing another loyalty above that to the nation state, is treated as the unforgivable crime. The nation state has taken the place of God," end quote. So ultimately, I would say it's the state and the religion of the state that's the opium of the masses. And unfortunately, Christianity has at times been co-opted to perform that function. But understood in its original context, and as Jesus and Paul and Peter expressed it, I think it's naturally resistant to performing that function.
Yeah, it's it reminds me so much of have you ever seen the movie with let's say, the book of, man, I can't think of anything today. The Book of Eli. Yeah.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, it's very much like that, right? Everybody wants to wield this religion for power.
Yes, there's also a lot of violence in that movie, but considering it's fictional, I'm okay with it. It's a good movie.
So you brought up nationalism, right? Which we could focus on a lot of different angles, but at least for us in our group, nationalism seems like it's a whole lot of religion trying to wield political power, right? And it works the other way around. I mean, dictators and people, they try to gain control of the church so that they can have power, right? But right now, from inside the church, we're not too happy that it seems like the church in the United States is grasping at political power so much. So we have this like hybrid. And have you ever read Verduin, Anatomy of a Hybrid?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Yeah, he talks about this hybrid, which is a great book that looks at that. But it's hard to kind of pull out who God is for our group right now, like God and his commands and integrity and all that stuff, or the state and its commands, talking about blasphemy and treason, like right there, we actually, it seems like we take blasphemy less serious than we do treason. So I'd love for you to kind of dig a little bit more into nationalism as we have it in our, our context today. And would you be able to compare modern Christian nationalists with your ideal of the anarchist Anabaptist? Like, if you're steeped in nationalism today, how would you envision something else? Like, what would your anarchist Anabaptist be? What are the pros to that? How do they look different?
So the last book I wrote was called Christian Nationalism, A Biblical Response, and almost all my books are very short. So if someone's interested, these are real quick reads because I hate a book that's longer than it needs to be. But without using the word anarchist or Anabaptist in that book, I presented a response to Christian nationalism that was essentially an anarchist Anabaptist response. I summarized the current state of Christian nationalist thought by highlighting five components that I thought were kind of central. One was that this is a just speaking of the five components of Christian nationalism. One is that Christians can serve Jesus and commit violence for Caesar without conflict, that you can have that sort of dual sacrament. And the counterpoint to that is that Jesus calls us to nonviolence. So there actually is a conflict sometimes between serving Christ and Caesar. And so that's something Christians have to keep in mind. The second component of Christian nationalism is a what they would call an optimistic eschatology, but essentially what it is this idea that because Jesus has come in the first century, Satan is no longer the god of this world. We can take it. That the state and its functions are not inappropriate for Christians to wield. And the counterpoint to that is that even though Jesus has, in one sense, defeated the powers, they actually are still in operation and they're connected to the political order. And so we can't just slap the word Christian on a nation and expect it to act like Jesus. So that's point two. There has to be, I think, really a strong distinction between the violence of government and what Christians are called to. The third component that you find in Christian nationalism is that the law of Moses is still in effect and we should force it upon others. And there's some variation, which is kind of funny, because Christian nationalists are so willing to enforce this stuff through violence, but they can't quite agree on what exactly it looks like. And so you have generally kind of a focus on the Ten Commandments. There's like theonomists who would sort of say all of the law of Moses or the general equity thereof, which what they mean by that is we sort of figure out how to recontextualize it in our time. But there's some who'd say, well, maybe not all the law of Moses, maybe the Ten Commandments. And some people would say, well, maybe just the last six of the Ten Commandments, because you can't really force somebody to, love God with their heart and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I was gonna say, like, hardly any Christian adheres to the whole Sabbath thing.
Right, there you go. Well, yeah, and there's some Christian nationalists who do, but of course they mean Sunday, but which the Bible never makes that change. And so the counterpoint to this idea that the law of Moses is still in effect and we should force it upon others is no on both counts. The law of Moses, I think, remains divinely inspired wisdom, but it's basically one of the conditions of a covenant that's no longer in operation. So if even Christians aren't expected to keep the law of Moses, it's doubly wrong for us to force it on non-Christians. The fourth component of Christian nationalism is that God wants to keep distinct people groups separate. And the counterpoint to this is basically just the gospel. It's the reclamation of all peoples and the invitation for individuals of all, tribes and tongues to leave behind their old loyalties and to join the multi-ethnic kingdom of God. So that's the counterpoint to that. Now, Anabaptists are not necessarily, well, they weren't that saying like, let's get rid of the state and by force. There is kind of a hint that perhaps as the gospel grows and everyone is saved, maybe the state becomes vestigial. But insofar as there are people who are not obeying Christ, it's almost like pagans have to have a way to deal with each other is kind of how they thought about it. But when you think about what the church is not, Rothbard called the state is like the predation over a territory, right? The predatory principle over a territory. That's not the way that the gospel works. The gospel is not concerned about either predation, violence, nor is it concerned with territory. It's the gospel isn't going to say, well, we're, there are, white Christians and black Christians, there's American Christians and French Christians. It's all, we're all part of the body of Christ. And then the last thing I think that you'll find in Christian nationalism is the idea that if something is true, that people should be forced to accept it. And the counterpoint to that is that not every truth should actually be backed by force. For instance, it's the truth that The Last Jedi was the best movie in the third Star Wars trilogy. But, it doesn't mean we should try to, take down people who disagree with that or silence them or put them in prison, right? Should we keep the Sabbath? Should it be Saturday? Should it be Sunday? Can women cut their hair? Can Christians eat meat sacrificed to idols? do maybe there may be very clear, right or wrong answers to these questions, but are they questions that we're actually willing to say we have to use force against those who disagree with us? And the biblical model is to leave a significant amount of room open for conscience and especially not to use violence to force our opinions on others. So that was, I think, kind of a long-winded answer, but I did want to cover, as well as I could, what I see as kind of the point and the counterpoint, Christian nationalism versus what I think an anarchist Anabaptist response to those things would be.
No, that's very helpful and succinct. Out of all those points, I guess the one that stands out to me, I can sympathize with a lot of those points from the nationalist perspective. It's like, okay, if you believe in objective morality and you believe that what you see in the Ten Commandments is objective, then like I get your point. I really don't understand. I think it was point four with the whole like keeping people groups separate. I don't get that from the Old Testament. I can see a little bit maybe, but especially the New Testament and then anecdotal history, like all the terrible things that have been done from that perspective. Like, how do they ground that one?
Yeah, so there's a couple places that you'll hear them try to go to. So Paul talks about how God had kind of arranged the times and places so that he could plan sort of ahead his grace to the world. And they say, well, there you go. God made the borders himself. There's something else that you hear. So I mean, actually, I'll start with that. Are you familiar with Bob Jones University, the kind of independent Baptist university in South Carolina?
Yes, a number of my teachers at my Christian school were from Bob Jones, so yeah.
And I had a couple who were from there as well. But yeah, up until, was it maybe 20 years ago, they had an anti-interracial dating policy. And not that you could tell because you couldn't even hold hands or anything. That was also against the rules, but their rationale was it was like kind of a separate but equal mentality. It's like, well, we're all human beings and the gospel is a call to go to everybody, but God drew the lines. Yes, of course, we also, got in boats and picked those people up and brought them here, but God drew the lines. And so, so I think there's a sort of sense that you can really believe in equal dignity of all human beings, but also believe that you should keep these people groups separate, keep the bloodline separate. I mean, maybe that's better than like just sort of straight up racism, but it's still, pretty bad. I've heard some talk about, and actually I've heard, I think progressives make a mistake too in interpreting this passage and Revelation where it talks about all the different tribes and tongues worshiping together. I've heard some on the right and some progressives suggest, well, look, the tribes and the tongues, they're all worshiping God, but they're doing it separately. The text doesn't really say that, but the rationale of that is, and you, like I said, you hear this from progressives and you hear this from the right, that we don't want to be mixing the cultures, that God actually intends for the French to be the French and the Nigerians to be the Nigerians and the Japanese to be the Japanese. And we should infuse those cultures with Christianity, but we shouldn't be mixing them. I mean, never mind the fact that that's something we've been doing since, time immemorial, and you couldn't straighten it out if you wanted to now. But that's the kind of, I think, rationale that you get from that is they'll try to say, yes, of course you're right. The gospel goes to all people, but God still is really interested in keeping people separate. I don't buy it, but that's what they argue.
Yeah, there are a lot of things that, I could say to that. It just, yeah, it doesn't make sense. But thanks for unpacking that. As we think a little bit more about government and nationalism, one of the reasons that nationalists are so adamant about their position is because they think they are doing God's work. And I think a lot of them truly believe that they are doing that. And a big part of their grounding is that, hey, look, the government is ordained by God, right? They're servants of God, ministers of God. So we need to use that. It would actually be negligent of us and sinful of us to not pursue that. So I think Romans 13 is so misunderstood, and there are 10 different ways to go about it. And I've come at it and I've read about it from tons of different ways. But I think that what you argue in this book, one of the arguments you put forward as a possibility, I think it was the first time that I actually saw this argument. I don't know what you call it, the argument from sarcasm. So I don't know if I really buy it. I think some of the other arguments are stronger, but I think it was a really interesting one. So I'd love for you to talk about maybe talk about the argument from sarcasm, but then also maybe give what you think is the strongest argument to dismantle Romans 13 as used by nationalists.
Yeah, so I mean, a decontextual surface reading of Romans 13 has Paul telling the Roman Christians to be subject to the governing authorities because they've been established by God and they're only a terror to wrongdoers. They're not a terror to those who do right. But if you've ever read more of the Bible than just this chapter, or if you're simply an adult who pays any attention to the world around you, you know that the state is very often a terror to those who do good. And here's the thing. Paul knows this too, because he worships a man who is wrongly crucified by both the Jewish and the Roman authorities, even though he was literally sinless. So are rulers a terror to those who do good? Yes, of course they are. And not only that, Paul's people have a history of being cruelly oppressed by different I mean by the Babylonians, by the Persians, by the Greeks, by the Seleucids. Paul himself has been whipped, stoned, beaten nearly to death on multiple occasions. I mean, unless he's saying, well, that's because I was doing wrong. Was I, you know, was he doing evil? No, he wasn't. He's spreading the gospel. And in this very section, Romans 12, 19, Paul even quotes a passage from Deuteronomy 32, where God promises vengeance against the pagan nations who oppose God's people. Now, well, who's doing that? Well, the Roman and Jewish leaders were opposing God's people in Paul's time. So there's even like in this passage where he goes on to say that rulers are not a terror to those who do good works, he puts in this little seed, this little hyperlink, and he says, well, go back to Deuteronomy 32 to see what I mean. And then you go back to Deuteronomy 32 and it's like, yeah, these people are wanting to oppress God's people and God's going to judge them. And that's that whole passage about oh gosh, the it's mine to avenge. What does it say? I'm the you got to help me, Derek.
Sorry.
Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord.
Yeah.
Yes, there we go. Thank you. I could, for some reason, I couldn't put the words together. So, in this passage where Paul says all this stuff, he has this hyperlink to this other passage. It says the opposite. So, why in the world is Paul saying that rulers are not a terror to those who do good? He 100% knows that isn't true. Is Paul lying? Like, what's he doing here? So, some have suggested that he's talking about the ideal government, the way government is supposed to work. And I think that could be part of what's going on here. But there's a scholar named T.L. Carter, and he has another proposal that I find persuasive. He argues that Paul is using irony. I think I call it the argument from sarcasm, you're right. But T.L. Carter, he's a little bit more subtle. He calls it the irony, the argument of irony. And so in describing the state in its ideal form, as it presents itself, there's a contrast that's created between the reality and the ideal that's so ridiculously comical that Paul's hearers will know that he's kind of being sarcastic. So if Paul says the state does this, and everybody knows that they don't do that, Paul's not BSing them. He's not lying. So he's, I think Carter argues, he's using irony. There's also something else that's happening here, which is if the letter is to get into the hands of authorities, they're going to read that and they're going to think Paul's being sincere and they're going to see Christianity as not subversive. And so while it's true that Christianity didn't pose a violent threat to the empire, they sought to live peaceably with all men, to obey the laws whenever possible, it's not true that they saw the state the way that Rome demanded that they do, which is that they're only doing good all the time. They had one Lord Jesus and he would vindicate them against their enemies. That is what Paul is saying when he goes back to Deuteronomy 32 there in his passage in Romans 12, 19. So that's kind of my basic pitch for the argument from irony is that if we all agree that what Paul is saying is not strictly true, then we have to figure out what he is doing.
So if you follow the argument from irony that Paul is being ironic there, how do you make sense of like his commands, whatever, pay taxes or to give what is due them? Because it sounds like he's then, is he then saying, well, no, don't give what is due them? Like, does he break off of the sarcasm there?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think if you were to ask Paul, should we pay taxes, he would say yes, and I think he would give the same argument for why that Jesus gave. If you remember the story about the coin that was in the fish's mouth, Jesus says, well, essentially the system is corrupt. Nevertheless, in order to avoid offense, let's pay it. I think that's ultimately what Paul would say is what Jesus has said there. So I think but Paul actually agrees that I think Paul is saying that you should pay taxes. I think the other part of the irony thing is, and so like I said, you can kind of, there's two ways to look at this. One is Paul is talking about the ideal government and Paul is being sarcastic. And those aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. I mean, I think Paul does believe that there is, it gets a little bit complicated, I guess, but I think Paul does actually believe that governance is necessary for pagans to keep each other in line. the way that the Anabaptists looked at this kind of stuff is they said, well, the state, the sword, that's outside of the perfection of Christ. So what made Anabaptists interesting and unique was that they practiced nonviolent correction. So they had, you know, the ban, they had discipline, church discipline, but it was always nonviolent. And they said, well, that works for people who are filled with the Holy Spirit. That works for Christians and people who are in union with Christ. It does not work for pagans. Pagans are going to have to use violence against each other. And I think, you know, Paul ultimately thinks that's probably true. I don't think that Paul would deny that. So yeah, it's I understand what you're saying, that there's a, you know, does the irony sort of continue all the way through? I think even if you don't take the irony view, if you don't, I think you said you don't really see it as maybe the most probable reading there. Would you say that it's like maybe the ideal government ideas is what he's getting at, or what do you think he's doing there?
So I, it's not that I don't necessarily think that the irony argument is bad. I just haven't mulled it over enough. I mean, it was very
Well,
new.
you can say it's bad if you think it's bad. I'm
Well,
just like
no,
I'm
I
figuring that
don't
you
be
didn't.
because Paul uses hyperbole and some other things at other places, like that help to make a lot of sense of some of the things he says elsewhere. So I think it would be par for the course for Paul to do that kind of thing. I just haven't thought about it enough through. I think Romans 12 is just a huge aspect of it for me. So if you view it holistically and just see he's telling Christians what to do, they're living in a world where the state exists, and okay, just like live peaceably, whatever, as best you can. And then right after the state, he says, you know, love one another. Like, so love each other in all these ways, even love your enemies, don't do violence. This is what the state does. They do that kind of thing, right? But you try not to have them terrorize you. All right, just go love each other.
No, and there could be this kind of idea, like, because I think Peter says something about this too, where he says, you know, if you're doing everything right, you'll be left alone. And he's like, but maybe you won't. He's like, but nevertheless, still try to do everything right and keep, you know, keep a high reputation among all. There is this thing, I mean, it's Romans 12 and 13 is so complicated because there's a lot of threads running through it. And so, like, yeah, if you start back at 12, you have Paul saying, you know, don't repay anyone evil for evil, do what's right in everyone's eyes. He quotes this passage in Deuteronomy 32, which is about God judging those pagans who are sitting in judgment on Israel. And so, like, okay, so is that part of what Paul's saying? Is Paul saying that the Christians are under persecution from Rome, you know, from the rulers, and that he's kind of putting in a subtle hint that God actually is going to take care of that? Well, like, that's possible. But then there's that whole thing about the vengeance, right? So he says, it's mine to avenge in chapter 12. And so you don't avenge, God will avenge. Then you get to 13 and he says, well, the magistrate is an avenger. So that's kind of saying, okay, well, don't avenge because God will, but then actually God might use the state to do that. Like, is that what he's saying? Or is he saying that God is actually going to judge the state? And it's like there's all these sort of ways that you could go with it, because there's so much that Paul is doing here and so many little references and the kind of threads that run through it. We'll sort of plant this word here, here, and here. So I mean, I'll admit that I don't maybe have like a totally simple, like, easy answer to what's going on in Romans 12 to 13, but I do think that irony is at least something worth considering, just because we know that Paul knows this isn't true. And we have to come up with an explanation for why Paul is saying something that he knows is false. And you know, maybe the hyperbole just covers it. Maybe it's the ideal, but yeah, it's tough.
I would add maybe two things. I think the you versus they language is helpful. You know, in Romans 12, it's all you do this, you. And then when you get to 13:1, he's like the state, they, government, they. And then right after he switches you love, you. And so there seems to be a distance, which you can explain in a number of ways. But the other thing that I think is interesting is, like, if you look at the word for minister there, I think that it is, like, in the Septuagint, you want to go verify this, but I think that in the Septuagint, that's what God calls Nebuchadnezzar in the Old Testament. And
That could be. I wanted to say when you were about to say that it was Cyrus, but it might be Nebuchadnezzar. I believe it's, isn't it just Diaconus?
I don't remember. 'Cause it was so long ago that I did my episode on it that, yeah, I don't remember. I
Yeah,
don't want.
it's Diaconus. And if we had a lot of time, I could actually tell you every time, because I got my Bible works up right now. I can tell you every time
Yeah.
it shows up in the Old
Well,
Testament.
I'll talk for like 30 seconds or a minute, and maybe that'll be enough time. But there's a passage in the Old Testament, and pretty sure it's about Nebuchadnezzar, but where God is talking about how Nebuchadnezzar is going to be his minister, and then it actually tells Israel to obey Nebuchadnezzar or submit to him, and that if they don't, there will be consequences. They'll be judged. And so you're like, I mean, Nebuchadnezzar is judgment on them, but then Nebuchadnezzar himself gets judged later,
Let me see here.
which
So,
reminiscent of Isaiah 10, where
yeah.
the judger gets judged.
So I'm seeing it show up in Esther. I see it in Fourth Maccabees, and I see it in Proverbs. Now that's the nounal form. But it could be that maybe an adjectival or a verbal form is
Yeah,
used, and
and
I'd have to look into
it might have also been just the English word minister, and it might not have been a Septuagint.
it. No, you may be right. I'll if I have a little bit of time, I'll look it up later and I'll let you know.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, cool.
Okay. So, last question for you. And this one, I mean, 95% of your book, I'm like all on board with. This one, it might not be that I'm not on board with. It might be like the irony argument where I just need some gaps to be filled in for me. And so that would be the part of your book where you talked a little bit more about like economics and free market and all that kind of stuff. And interrupt me if anything that I characterize what you say as is wrong, like just to interrupt me and you can correct that. But it seemed like in your book you defend capitalism a bit, and I know you talked about like Roman wealth and their inequality and how that is drastically different than our world today, and how capitalism has really been a big part of what has helped to make our times better in some ways. And I don't necessarily disagree with that, and I definitely agree that freedom and a lack of coercion are very Christian things. But like I also understand that one of the reasons that the state exists and the reason that the Bible, maybe, if Paul's not being ironic, maybe calls the state a terror to those who do evil is because like sometimes people who do use their freedom in bad ways, serial killers, people who commit injustice, right? The state uses violence against those people in return. And so telling the state not to do violence, like you had talked about, one of the arguments is like Paul thinks that the pagans need to police the pagans type of thing. So telling the state not to do violence just seems like it's talking against the natural order. It'd be like telling an apple not to fall off of a tree, right? But gravity is the natural law. That's kind of the way the world works when you're not. It's just the way the world works. Like violence is the way that the world works when you're not living under the kingdom of God. So economics seems very similar to me as violence does here, right? And I feel like a lot of times capitalists tend to ignore the facts of what capitalism seems to lead to. Like it seems like capitalism, maybe not exclusively, but more so than other systems, maybe leads to things like ecocide or plutocracy or fascism. Again, maybe not more than other systems, but as much as, at least to really terrible things. And like we can point to Mao and we can point to Stalin. Yes, they do terrible things too. But I guess like as a Christian, it seems like I would critique both. I'm not like when I if I live in a socialistic government, I'm going to critique that because of their indulgences. But in a capitalistic one, it seems like it leads to just as bad of things. So I guess to make a long question short, why do you feel the need to defend capitalism so much when it seems like it leads to excesses, and you're speaking into the void against a system that is trying, like against socialism and other systems which are now trying to correct the extravagance of a pendulum that swung too far.
Yeah. I mean, so there's a lot, so much I could say here. I'll start with something simple that maybe we'll come back to, which is that indulgence is not the same as aggression. And so if you can look and say, wow, when people are free, they drink too much and maybe they sleep around, like, yeah, that's a sin. But like, what's the alternative to dealing with that problem? It's like, well, you can try to persuade them not to, or you can say, I'm going to use force. And we're going to punish the adulterers, and we're going to punish the homosexuals, and we're going to punish the alcoholics. So it's like what Lysander Spooner, I think he's an anarchist in the 19th century. He wrote a book, a pamphlet called "Vices Are Not Crimes," and so that's one thing I would want to distinguish is that I, as much I might share a lot of your critiques about self-indulgence and what happens when people become wealthy sometimes. But I also would strongly distinguish between a vice and a crime, between indulgence and aggression. But I think maybe even more than that, if we're so, I've been thinking about this. I was just asked by Preston Sprinkle for his podcast because he had kind of some questions about this, about how capitalism and but which I'm defining as free markets. I'm not, when I had to talk about capitalism, I'm not talking about the union of state and corporations. That's corporatism. Capitalism is free markets. But Sprinkle said, doesn't that sort of take away what the church is supposed to do? If every if everybody sort of has what they need and more so, the church isn't going to provide those things. And I thought, and what I should have said, I think we got onto something else, was, yeah, that's true, but we're still gonna, like, the church is still needed. I mean, but like, would you say, like, I want my neighbors to starve so that I can give them a biscuit? Like in the name of Christ. It's like, I mean, no, I mean, I think we can still offer them a good, like, some good news even without having to starve them first, right? And so how do we build that kind of society? And the Catholic anarchist Dorothy Day once said, everybody wants a revolution, but nobody wants to do the dishes. And what I get from that is that the ideal society that we want to create, I think, that Christians want to create, actually, I'll start over. The ideal society that we as Christians would really like to see is one that requires a level of selflessness and generosity that few people are actually willing to give of themselves. The best society, therefore, is not the one with the highest ideals. It's a society that can deliver the most benefits, even when nobody wants to do the dishes. So, what kind of society is that? It's a society that can meet the needs and even wants of the most amount of people without violence and without expecting everyone to be a saint. And that is a free market society. And I don't think you can really dispute that. So, the world economy stayed largely stagnant for thousands of years, but since 1820, it's grown more than a hundredfold. We've obliterated extreme poverty. We've more or less gotten rid of famine. We've shrunk the number of wars, even. We've significantly reduced violent crime. And what caused that? It wasn't people following Basil of Caesarea's scolding exhortation that the extra shirt that you have in your closet was stolen from the poor, as much as I like Basil and appreciate what he's trying to do there. It wasn't the communist egalitarian notion that everyone should have the same amount of wealth. It was capitalism. Capitalism has been the greatest program for creating jobs, prosperity, health, wealth, right? And peace that humans have devised. And I think that is good news. Western Christians shouldn't go around feeling guilty because we live in a country where we can have two or more shirts. I mean, if you only want to have one shirt, then, that's wonderful. That's between you and God. But we should thank God that there's enough freedom where we live that not just us, but our neighbors actually can have more access to transportation, medicine, food, technology, clothing, more of that than a fourth century nobleman could have dreamed of. The kind of, I mean, what Basil Caesarea is correcting there. I mean, he's looking at every the almost pretty much most of the poorest of Americans have more than Basil thinks that they should have. I like the fact that my neighbor might be able to take a vacation. I think that that's a good thing. I would like for all of my neighbors to be able to, everybody in my community, everybody in my state, everybody in my country, everybody in my world, to be able to have, enough food and a place to, a place to live that keeps them out of the rain and the cold. And I don't think that, I don't think that that's, a bad thing to want. That, that fourth century nobleman that Basil was critiquing, he did it by stealing the wealth of the poor. And by stealing men and women to be slaves. He did it by his connections with the state and by taxing people and taking it for himself. We can do it without having to hurt, enslave, or steal from a single person. And so, and what's interesting is, that a lot of that is done without generosity. And but that's not to put down generosity. Christians are called to generosity, whether we live in a rich country or a poor country. I think we should be interrogating our lives and our checkbooks to see if we're living for now or if we're investing in a future kingdom. And to be very personal, I struggle to pay all my bills, but I still worry. I think, I should be giving more. I gotta come up with a better plan. So I'm maybe, getting the kids McDonald's less and being able to, but I think that's a good thing to be able to think about. I may have all these things that other people haven't had throughout life, but I think we need to be thinking about what it means. Do we have too many shirts in our closet? And I think that's very personal. What I don't want to see is somebody from the state who says, I don't want to see Basil of Caesarea with a sword coming from house to house and saying, "You've got too many coats. You've got too many shirts." And I think that's what we're suggesting if we're opposed to free markets. We're saying that, because some people are going to have too much, we have to take it from them. Now, if they have too much because they stole it, if they have too much because they're oppressing somebody, that's one thing. If they have too much because, they have a good job and whatever, I mean, you can critique, you can say, tell them that they're in sin and rebuke them if you want, but I don't think what you can do is use violence against them. And so that's where my kind of, free market anarchism comes in. But now, okay, what do we do about the people who pollute, the corporations who buy Congress people so that they can use the force of government to harm competition, to avoid justice for themselves? Well, I'd say these are aggressive acts. These are antithetical to a libertarian society. They're anti-free market. They're coercive and they're counterproductive for the same reason that socialism is. And that's because they're an unhealthy amalgamation of markets and the state. And libertarians don't support corporate handouts. They respect the rights of individuals to not be polluted. Capitalism, once again, is not corporatism. That's not the joining of corporations in the state. It's that freedom to buy and sell with people that you want to, so long as you're not hurting each other. It's about it's what I like, voluntarism. So insofar that we have government, whatever we think that should look like, ultimately, I think. Really, what the early Anabaptists would say, and what anarchists, libertarian anarchists also say, is that the role of governance is to protect individuals from aggression, which would include things like excessive pollution. And so there are some quotes I have in the book from Menno Simons, from Hutter, that I think give some. So I'll quote one now from Hutter where he talks. He gives this sort of warning to government magistrates. He says, "Woe, we say to you, who fear more that frail and mortal man than the living, omnipotent, and eternal God, and chase from you suddenly and inhumanely the children of God, the afflicted widow, the desolate orphan, and scatter them abroad. Great slaughter, much misery and anguish, sorrow and adversity, yea, everlasting groaning, pain, and torment are daily appointed you. And the Most High will lift his hand against you now and eternally." And so I think from an Anabaptist perspective, there is a function for governance, but that function is not to say, "I don't like the religion you're practicing. I don't like how many shirts you have in your house. I don't like that your TV is so big." It's really to, I think, protect people from aggression. So that's my very long-winded response to that question.
Yeah, and like you said, I mean, there's a whole lot to say here. I'll just say two things. I think I'm just gonna disagree with you on greed as non-aggression, or what the words that use vices, or like
Vices are not crimes.
I think, I mean, I agree with that to an extent. Like somebody getting drunk on their own, that's on them, right? That's a vice. But there is at least some level, and I think it's very biblical. Even Preston Sprinkle, bringing him up in his book People to Be Loved, he's got this section that, they say it's a terrible thing. It's the Bible says this, it's got this many verses on, and he's talking about greed, wealth, hoarding, accumulation, that type of stuff. Because the Bible talks a lot about it, and injustice, exile, all kinds of things are tied to it. And we could discuss what level that is, of course. But I think, and the early church, Chrysostom, Basil, there are a lot of people who were very strongly worded against how, all riches come from injustice, as that the book quotes. I think Chrysostom.
And I think that was truer then, and I think that was kind of the point I made about just that connection between church, not church and state, but wealth and state. And it's not like that's completely gone away, but I think where we've seen the greatest amount of growth for the poor, for the middle class, for all of these people, has come from, I think, unshackling those markets to a lot of degree. Basically, to say that when people are engaging in voluntary arrangements, I mean, when I go and buy milk at my local Kroger, because I live near Kroger, they're happy to sell me the milk, and I'm happy to get the milk. And so there's not actually anything that's happened where someone has been oppressed by that transaction. We actually both see ourselves as benefiting from it. And that's what I think what you get from voluntary arrangements. There might be some things where I'm like, man, the cost of heat has gone up too much, or the cost of gas is, I feel like, has gone up too much. But, I could always just choose not to pay it and have to deal with the consequences. Now, some would say, well, that's a shame. You shouldn't have to do that. You shouldn't have to do that. It should be a guaranteed right. Well, that means that somebody from the state has to take a sword and say, well, I'm going to make sure that everybody has gas to heat. And so I'm going to put a sword against somebody and say, you have to produce it. I'm going to put a sword up to somebody and say, you have to distribute it. And so, I mean, I just think from a, I think when you talk about greed, when you talk about, there's so many sins you could talk about, greed, sexual sin, whatever. I think we would agree on most of these, what the Bible calls sins, maybe not most. I'm not sure what the number would be, but that we don't see those as things that the state should actually be using a sword or governance or whatever to enforce.
So to clarify, I mean, obviously you don't use a sword. You don't, so you would not use a sword, and you would critique the government for using the sword unjustly. But if the government uses a sword to intervene in violent affairs, like again, just easy serial killer, the police go out, you would not wield a weapon, but you're not going to critique the state for using violence to apprehend somebody who does violence.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a certain point, like if you're talking, do you blow up a city block to get a terrorist? Right. But yes. I mean, so if
But direct violence to the one doing the violence from the state.
The least amount possible in order to make sure that justice is done and that the innocent are protected.
So then, yeah, I guess that would just be where we'd have to hammer out agreement in the future. If we were going to talk about it, would just be whether or not, and at what point does it become violence if corporations are, if it's a plutocracy, if they're controlling votes, if they've hoarded wealth, what is it, like, I have to pay for a roof over my head. I could pay for a cheaper one, but still, it's the housing prices and why the market is the way that it is. Like, it's very convoluted, but it sure seems like there's violence being done.
I think there is, and I think it's being done by the state. So, in particular, why is housing so expensive? Well, it's so expensive because of the building codes that make it very difficult for houses to be built. It's expensive because of all the overhead that the government creates that makes that expensive. It's expensive because Donald Trump is introducing tariffs, which means that I can't get lumber from Canada that's inexpensive. I have to buy more expensive lumber. That's, made stateside or whatever. And so, those are, and you talked about, trying to control votes or trying to control congressmen. Yeah, that's aggression. That's using the force of the state against people to make them do things that they don't want to do.
But then I guess here's the question, and I know you're not, a psychic, but don't you think that because of humans grasping at power, like, that's what capitalism inevitably leads to? And when it gets to a certain point that people get fed up, not that you justify this, but like, it's going to create revolution, like French Revolution and stuff, and it's going to swing back. Like, they need to do things to, or they will do things to correct it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't see that a voluntary society needs a correction. I think there are corrections that need to be made. I think moving to a more coercive, more violent society is not the correction that we need. Now, is it possible that some people will push things in that direction? Like, during Russia under the Tsar, I've heard people say, well, if you look at kind of over time, things were getting moving in a better direction, and the Tsar was, putting his, foot on boot on the throats of the proletariat less than he had been. But ultimately, yeah, they said this is actually, I think this is what I said about Donald Trump too, was that people sort of said, well, it's so bad it couldn't be worse. Right. And so we've got to do something different. And it's like, yeah, it actually can get worse. And that's 100% what happened in with the Bolshevik Revolution, right? I mean, I what I hope is that people will say, I would rather live in a voluntary society than a violent one. I would rather live in a free society than a coerced one. And I think what we've seen is, I mean, that free markets can provide all of these things, but in so long as there is a state that can be co-opted, if you are a major, producer of lumber, and you can buy a congressman to make sure that your competitors are pushed out, and you can raise prices and not have anybody to compete with, of course you're going to try to do that. But I think, like I said, I mean, capitalism has been. There's a great book by Marion Tupi and oh gosh, what's his name? Oh shoot. Hold on, I'll look it up here. Sorry, it's called is it 10 Trends, 10 Global Trends? Let me find it. I'm gonna find it. Sorry, 10 Global Trends Every Smart Person Should Know. Marion Tupi and Ronald Bailey, they're basically pointing out that despite all the doom and gloom and the sense that we have that things are getting worse, that over the last couple hundred years, all the trends are really pointing up, and I think that's a good thing. Like I understand that we want to point out what's wrong with the world, and we want something to complain about, and we want to be activists. But I think there's good news in the fact that maybe to clothe the poor, you don't have to empty out your closet. Like you could actually just let like free people, engage in trade, and then everybody's going to be better for it. I mean, I think that's a good thing. Now that doesn't mean that, those who are, struggling with mental illness, those who have been abandoned by their families, I mean, it's not like the free markets are going to fix everything, every, problem that we have. There's still room for the church. There's still room for charity. There's still room for us to come alongside and help others. But I mean, to me, it's kind of nice to think that the heavy lifting can be done, not by everybody having to do the dishes for the revolution, but by just free people trying to feed their families and take care of their kids, and somehow everybody does better. I think that's a great thing.
I guess maybe you're just more optimistic than me, 'cause I totally agree with that. I just think that's maybe Howard Wasserman here. Like I think that's the church. Like the church does that. The church is the free market. The church is because the church critiques greed, and people are expected to be generous. But a capitalist state is going to end up creating a plutocracy, and then it's going to swing, and Marxism and socialism are going to create injustice. And so the church is the prophetic witness, the living witness in the world.
Yeah, there's who was it who said it? The anarchist sociologist. He said that there are two ways to produce wealth, or to gain wealth or something like that. One is production, and the other is predation. So you can either produce wealth or you can steal it. And so when I hear people say, like, we need to do something about free markets, what I'm hearing is we need to use violence to take something from somebody and give it to somebody else. That strikes me wrong, both as an anarchist and also as an Anabaptist. But I understand what you're saying. I think is there do I have a reference, I think, to the book by, oh my gosh, we're both forgetting names right now. The Brethren of Christ, Brethren in Christ, theologian who wrote the book about poverty and
Oh yeah, Cider,
Yeah, Church of the Brethren. Sorry, yeah, Ron Sider. I referenced that his book. I'm gonna find it here. Sorry, Consider is coming up all over the place, but not Ron Sider. Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger, and how much he was. I think he still was really pushing for a more progressive approach to markets and to regulation of markets. But there were so many changes from the 1977 edition to the 1997 edition, because he backtracked considerably, though not totally, on his initial criticisms of free market capitalism, because he'd actually become increasingly aware of its capacity to improve the lot of those whom Jesus called the least of these. I think that's a good thing. And you know, I do think obviously the church still has responsibilities. There are things that the church can do that nobody else can do. But I would not say if there's a way that we can, without having to lift a finger, really, I mean, I'm sort of exaggerating a little bit, but that all of our poor neighbors could be better off. Like, would we want to do that? Like, I think I'd want to do that. And so that's essentially the argument. But I don't want to overstate, because I think we've kind of made our cases back and forth, and I don't want to bore people with it. But that's essentially where I would come down on.
Well, awesome. Well, that was the last question I had for you.
Okay.
I'd love for you, I think you have like a coupon code and something, anything to
Yeah.
plug.
Yeah, so the main book is The Anarchist Anabaptist. That's mostly what we've been kind of talking about today. Depending on when somebody listens to this, it could be still under pre-order on Kindle and on paperback. Kindle, of course, you order from Amazon, but there's a pre-order for paperback at libertarianchristians.com. You can also find all that info, links to buy, also other interviews. I'll post this one once it's live, and that's at anarchistanabaptist.com. And if you order that paperback from libertarianchristians.com, you can put in the coupon code anarchist25 at checkout and get 25% off. People who are interested in the book can do that. I've got another book coming out sometime this year from Wipfenstock that's like a concise Anabaptist systematic theology called The Pocket Anabaptist. I don't have a coupon code for that. You can't pre-order it yet, but it is coming out at some point.
And that is true. It is concise. Like you don't use that word lightly. Your books are very good at getting to the point, and you can get through a book without feeling overwhelmed. So,
I'm glad to hear that. Thank you. Yeah. I've heard some people who say they're afraid, you know, there's people I know at church or whatever who say, I'm afraid I wouldn't be able to understand your books. But when I have somebody read it and say, oh yeah, this was a breeze, that makes me feel really good about it.
Of course, there's always a trade-off. Like you know, but if you want more, you can always go get more.
That's true. Well, and I feel like if occasionally you have to Google a word, that's not that big of a deal. Like if you're having to do that constantly or you can't like follow the flow of the sentence, that's a problem. But yeah, there's nothing wrong with occasionally having to look up a word. I feel like that's reasonable.
Yeah, you got to learn something.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks again for taking your Friday night to do this.
Well, thank you, Derek, because like I said, I came to you with this and you took your Friday night to make time to talk to me, so I really appreciate it.
All right. Yeah, have a great night.
You too.
That's all for now. So peace, and because I'm a pacifist, when I say it, I mean it. This podcast is a part of the Kingdom Outpost Network. Please check out the links below to find other great podcasts and content related to nonviolence and kingdom living.